is Doug Thorpe. This is the first session in a series of classes on Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And really, what I want to do is to set this novel in the context of 1962 and talk in part about what was going on in 1962 as well as the novel. During the course of the week, I'll also be bringing in some poetry, primarily work of William Stafford. He was a wonderful Oregon poet. Volume of his called Traveling Through the Dark came out in 1962. And also some of the work of Gary Snyder, who is originally a Washington State resident, born just outside of Seattle in Lake City Way. When Lake City Way, those of you who know Seattle, it was actually farm country when Snyder was born. Snyder was born in 1930. And Snyder, of course, famously connected to the poets, good friend of Allen Ginsberg and so on. So I want to use those to sort of juxtapose with the work of Ken Kesey. First, how many of you have read at some point in your life and maybe have no memory of it, but I did at one time read One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? Okay, so about half of you. And some of you have seen the movie with Jack Nicholson, famously, 1975. Film directed by Milo Forman, wonderful director, won all sorts of Academy Awards. The film really has something to do with the novel, but I just watched the film again for the first time probably since it came out, and I mean Nicholson is a great performer, but there's a really important ingredient missing from the film, which is the voice of Chief Bartman. He's the narrator of the novel, and he's gone from the film, so it's a tremendously different experience from actually reading the book. Okay, so I gave you these little tablets, and this is a class that's going to begin with a quiz. You don't have to learn anything from Cuckoo's Nest, but here's the question. What, and I'm looking around, there are some exceptions of people who were not alive in 1960. For those of you who were around in 1962, the question would be, what is your memory of 1962? What is your reality of 1962? What is your context, your family context, your geographical context? What images come up in 1962? Any memories? And there may not be anything. 1962, I've been saying to people, it's not one of those watershed years. It's not like 1963, the Kennedy assassination. It's not like 1968, the Robert Kennedy, the Martin Luther King assassination, 2001. I mean, there are certain dates that are just forever etched in their memories. So 1962 might not conjure up too much of anything, but I'm curious what it does. And for those of you who are not alive, do you have any image at all? What is your image? And just jot down words. And it could be totally imaginary. And if you need paper, there's paper here.
Some of us need writing implements, too.
And, yeah, I don't have more writing instruments. What comes to mind when you think about 1962? You can start personally, but then also, what was going on? What was happening in Europe? An example, of course, those of you familiar with Seattle, the World's Fair. So that's a good example. To when you're done with these pieces of writing at the end of class a day or at the end of the week, or if you have other memories, other things that come up, jot them down. Jot down phrases, words, memories. And if you're willing to allow me to incorporate some of them, I would love to do that. So just during the course of the week again, you know, it's the reason I chose this novel obviously is to coincide with the 50th anniversary of Holden. And so I thought it would be interesting to, as we're sitting here at Holden, and as there is a fair amount of reflection going on about this place 50 years ago, I want to start with this particular geographical location, but then also move outward and try to experience in some ways, okay, so what was this place like in 1962? What was it like where I was living or where my family was living? What was it like in the country? What was going on in the neighborhoods? And we each have our own reality around that. So, and remind me, Casey?
Mm-hmm.
Casey's, we had lunch together. So Casey, I'll use you as a guinea pig if I may for a moment, since you're obviously. So any idea when your parents were born?
My mom was born in 60 and my dad in 59.
That's right, okay, 59, 60. So so the question would be to put to them, and we had a little bit of this conversation at lunch, like, okay, so what is your sense, what are your memories? And then your grandparents, you know, what was going on? Where were they living? Where were your parents living in 1962, any idea?
My mom was in Seattle and my dad was in Madagascar.
Madagascar, okay. And your grandparents?
Same.
Okay. Of course, because they were here. So this notion of 1962, what was going on? I had this strange moment earlier this afternoon. I was sitting up in on a porch outside of one of the chalets, and I'm working on this piece of stuff, and all of a sudden I hear this astonishing noise, probably many of you witnessed it.
The jet
going
by. Oh.
The jet going by.
That's a prowler.
Huh?
It was a prowler from Woodby Island.
Okay. The naval base?
Yeah. Back in the 90s, I remember hiking up here, and when I was in Seattle River Valley, one day, the first day of the hiking, those were intruders in those days, and it flew over me, and the next day we were up higher and it flew below me.
Yes. Yeah. My wife and I had a similar experience. We were hiking up an area called Green Mountain years ago, and we had reached the summit and were sitting up there having a very peaceful lunch, and these jets came down below us through the valley. But my point is that there was something shocking about the shift in context. I mean, here I am sitting at Holden and looking out at the village and their kids, and I mean, it's this sort of classic Holden scene, an August afternoon in Holden. And then all of a sudden, that jet goes by, and it's a whole different reality.
Yeah, we were up at Holden Lake, and you know, it was so peaceful, you couldn't hear anything but the brook, you know, and then it literally right over our heads, and we could see it perfectly.
Yeah,
and it was so loud. I mean, it wasn't one of those where it's like you hear the noise first, or it was.
No.
I mean, the noise was right in conjunction. Yes. Like it was right above our heads.
Yeah,
it was very memorable.
That's the way. That's the why they fly it that way.
Oh, Warner said that they used to try to fly below the radar to get back to Whidbey, so they it was a game they were playing.
Oh, yeah.
So they'd fly in the.
Well, this one was outbound.
They complained to Woody, and they stopped him for a while. So.
Yeah.
This one was outbound. But one flew over the cuckoo's nest today.
That's right.
So 1962, memories?
Will I get the CO?
Yeah.
And then I was starting college, and it was Lutheran College.
Yeah.
And it was really transitional from the old ways. It's changed.
Yeah, so that's a good word for strong sense of the transition.
Very transitional time. Yeah. And you can see it, I mean, you know, between 62 and 63,
Yeah.
So my brother was born in 1962, and what's interesting about that was that my father was a college student at the time, and he was at an all-male school, and you couldn't be married and go to this school. And he actually got kicked out of college because he had a baby on the way and had to get married. So it's to me a very dated situation, you know. It doesn't happen. That just is sort of inconceivable now. Any college?
Yes, yes. Yeah. Possible exception of liberty. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know, but yeah. Okay. So 62 has a strong connotation. Yes.
I wrote down a couple of things because I was here in Seattle, the Seattle World Fair. That was a really, really big thing. I was 10 years old, so that, you know.
You're, of course, we think of as, you know, associated with Camelot, JFK. That was the surface, at least. I'm also struck by, we those of us certainly who were alive, have our own stories of that time, and simultaneously, there were these world-shaking events going on. There was the missile crisis. And I've jotted down a few things. I'm going to read you a passage of a book that will also help to contextualize this a little bit. So, John Glenn, Surface of the Earth, 1962. This is entirely different. If you've seen the movie Animal House?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
1962, the film is set in 1962 at the University of Oregon. I mentioned that because that's when Kesey was at the University of Oregon. Mm-hmm. They're filming at his fraternity house, basically. So there's this curious overlap with that. James Bond, Dr. No, 1962. Mm-hmm. I mean, that gives some context to what's going on. And the other thing is that August 5th, papers just a few weeks ago, celebrated, is that the word, marked the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of the death of Marilyn Monroe. And those of you know who were around, I mean, Marilyn Monroe, iconic. I mean, hard to underestimate the extraordinary influence and popularity that she had. It was quite phenomenal.
Back then, I thought she was old.
Yeah. Well, she was 36 when she was
36.
36. Yeah. 1962. The Beatles are putting out their first records. The Beach Boys. Surfing is the only life, the only way for me. Now surfing with me. Very early. The Beach Boys are happening in 1962.
Chubby Checker.
Twist. Blend. Chandler, Duke of Earl, I mean, those of you who were Fuller Contacts. It's a book called Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, 1954 to 1963 by Taylor Bratch. Obviously, this is a huge volume, over 1,000 pages. I highly recommend it. It's an amazing, amazing book. Not really even a biography of King, but putting the civil rights movement into the context of American politics and history during those years. And of course, he's also talking about 1962. And so, just a few passages. All this, I'm just, again, trying to give us a context today. We'll you know, do this. We're gonna look at the opening passage of the novel and then move more deeply into it tomorrow. But on each day, I wanna do a little discontextualizing. So, this is the way Taylor Bratch begins his 15th chapter. The chapter is called Hoover's Triangle and King's Machine. And anybody around would recognize that Hoover would be
J. Edgar Hoover.
Okay. Then came the last year of post-war innocence, is how he begins this chapter. The last year of post-war innocence. So this is post-World War II, obviously. What can you say, John Glenn exclaimed after orbiting the globe, about a day when you've seen four beautiful sunsets. Mickey Mantle won the Most Valuable Player Award. John Steinbeck won the Nobel Prize for Literature. Intellectuals and Hollywood directors still showcase cigarette smoke as a positive image, paying little attention to obscure health warnings from Britain's Royal College of Physicians. The first of the baby boom children turned 16, snatched up driver's licenses, created a new stage of life within Detroit's shining creations. The Ford Motor Company designed tiny cars to compete with the German Volkswagen. But Henry Ford publicly dropped the idea as un-American. America was king, though some of its newly powerful citizens ached for the settled refinements of Europe. Cardinal Spellman announced he'd arranged to bring Michelangelo's Pieta to New York for exhibition. On television, a new show called The Beverly Hillbillies unexpectedly broke the hegemony of the Westerns atop the ratings charts. Most of the most popular TV shows were Westerns. Gunsmoke, Bonanza, Have Gun Will Travel, and so on and so forth. All this stuff is still showing up on whatever channel that is. So replacing frontier adventure with social satire that blended the extremes of gushing wealth and heartwarming naivete. Through John and Jacqueline Kennedy, declared a story in the New York Times, the average American has a much clearer idea of what it must be like to have everything. Future writers chose 1962 as the year of nostalgia, the perfect setting for surf comedies and carefree romances. So that's this image of 1962. And of course, what Peter Branch is doing is talking about the Civil Rights Movement, what's going on in Mississippi, what's going on in Georgia in 1962. Martin Luther King is arrested and put in jail in Albany, Georgia in 1962. Bob Moses is working in Mississippi in 1962, and so on and so forth. There's amazing events unfolding in the Civil Rights Movement. And this passage, I want to read this, and then I want to juxtapose it to the opening of the Kesey novel. And my question in advance is, what's the connection between these two things, which apparently have no connection? What I'm about to read is material that no one would have known anything about in 1962. The image is what Taylor Branch just gave us, this notion of the last year post-war innocence, of kind of nostalgia. And then we get this. We find out Robert Kennedy, who was the Attorney General, had been circling the globe, speaking up about American values. And what he found was that everywhere he went, everybody was asking him about civil rights. Everyone was asking him about what was going on in this country. And then also asking him about, you know, will America support their own nation's desire for liberty and so on. J. Edgar Hoover welcomed the attorney home on February 27th with a dose of scandal so fantastic that even the most credulous readers of supermarket tabloids would have dismissed it as lurid fantasy. Hoover's memo was the result of an investigation that had begun sometime earlier when FBI agents in Las Vegas arrested private parties for placing illegal wiretaps on the home of singer Phyllis McGuire. This is going to be hard to track, so just bear with me. Preliminary development of the wiretap prosecution had shown that the wiretappers were in the employ of Robert Mayhew, a former FBI agent working for Howard Hughes, and working for Sam Giancana, who was Al Capone's mobster heir in Chicago. I'm from Chicago. I'm from Oak Park, Illinois, and I used to walk by a house that everybody knew was owned by one of the families of the mob and so on. In fact, one of my friends, his older brother, and so on. I mean, this is just part of history. So that much was good news to the entire Justice Department. Hoover loathed Mayhew as a bureau renegade, and Kennedy had sought the conviction of Giancana almost as diligently as he had that of Jimmy Hoffa. But the first of the bad news was that Mayhew and Giancana claimed immunity from prosecution on the grounds that their wiretap was sanctioned by the CIA. Officials from the CIA, in turn, had confirmed that Mayhew and Giancana had been working for them in a series of top secret attempts to assassinate Cuban Premier Fidel Castro by means of Giancana's gangster connection. Giancana, while plotting these missions, and here's where it gets thicker. Giancana, while plotting these missions, had asked Mayhew and the CIA to make sure that his mistress, Phyllis McGuire, was not two-timing him while he was away. And the agency officials had decided they were in no position to refuse. So the CIA had authorized wiretaps on this singer. That's not all.
We've been waiting for it.
Yes, wait, there's more.
You
buy this.
Yeah.
Free shipping. Further investigation, plus the wiretaps themselves, had revealed that Phyllis McGuire nursed her own complaints about the relationship with Giancana, including the fact that Giancana maintained a second mistress in California named Judith Campbell. Singer Frank Sinatra had introduced Campbell to Giancana and to other gangsters with whom he socialized. And then it gets thicker. Sinatra also had introduced Judith Campbell to John Kennedy, it turned out. And both John and Robert Kennedy, Sinatra introduced to Marilyn Monroe, among others, in a serial exchange of lovers. In fact, and this is Taylor Branch's aside, it seemed that Sinatra did as much introducing as singing, and that his libertine social network included glittering figures of many kinds, from politics, gangsterdom, and show business. Giancana, for his part, was old school gangster, not merely in the assumption of his prerogative to wiretap one lady friend while carrying on himself with another, but also in his practical view of social matters. His affair with Campbell was strictly business, bestowing enormous hidden power upon him because he shares a mistress with the President of the United States. Astonishing. It required all of J. Edgar Hoover's genius to boil down such steaming pulp into the dignified drone of policy phone records that confirmed that Judith Campbell had placed some 70 calls at the White House in the year since Kennedy. CIA officials opposed criminal prosecution of Giancana or Mayhew for fear of compromising the national security operations against Castro. The ramifications of this one Las Vegas arrest could spell disaster for the administration, you can well imagine. It meant that the CIA and the Kennedy brothers had poisoned the US government's chances of prosecuting Giancana and associated gangsters for any of their crimes. They had exposed the U.S. government to disgrace as one that pursued murder and pursued partnership with gangsters, and exposed the president to blackmail as a consort of gangster women. Hoover summarized the whole package with professional detachment. But private satisfactions converged from many directions. He loved having dirt on the Kennedys. So he is immune. But the Kennedy administration wanted to get rid of Hoover, right? And it was impossible to do that. And of course, we also know Taylor Branch goes into great detail about what Hoover is doing to the civil rights movement. Yeah. That is, he is doing everything imaginable to undermine what King and his associates are doing. And Hoover was untouchable because of all of this. Okay. So, what does all this have to do with Ken Keyes?
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes, sure.
For those of us who weren't alive at that time, what specifically did Hoover do to undermine the civil rights movement in a nutshell?
In a nutshell, wiretapped, often didn't give protection to King. The wiretapping was some of it. I mean, he was convinced that King was, associated with communists, and that was the only thing that really mattered to Hoover.
And it was widely publicized. And many people believed because Jacob.
Yes.
That Martin.
Yes. So often, I mean, King would be going to Chicago, and would be trying to create a rally, and Hoover would send out memos to people, undermining King's credibility.
He also sent sent people in to create problems in within the movement too.
Yeah.
He recruit people to
yeah.
I just can't remember. When did this
hold the GymCon and all of this stuff. When did it become really public?
Decades later.
I'm not sure.
And again, speaking of differences between 1962 and now, I mean, it was simply, if you were a reporter and you knew some of this, you simply didn't report it in 1962. Obviously, things have changed dramatically.
And you didn't have the scandal press. I mean,
right, not in the same kind of way.
Yeah, you know, now if that would happen, it would be all over the papers and, you know.
He tweeted.
Yeah.
papers would be the
bloggers and
snail mail. Yeah.
I remember that during the Democratic Convention in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. and I did go to the Coliseum.
Yes.
For the end of it, which was very exciting. A friend of mine was dating a Secret Service agent who, his name was Arthur Godfrey of all names. Anyway, I was hearing all this dirt, really, about the Kennedys and their sexual escapades.
Yes.
So I was hearing that in, wait, 61 or earlier.
In real time.
But yes. it was all hushed up, and it was just, oh, that's just really not really happening.
Yes. Yes, so.
It's very interesting, though, hearing it, thinking about it now, again, hearing it firsthand, the Secret Service were there.
Oh, yes. So, you know, there's this contrast, obviously, massive contrast between a surface reality, our sense of Jackie Kennedy and John Kennedy, and those years, and what in fact was going on. And that's not to say there nothing positive is happening. Obviously, Kennedy did some very good things, but there was this whole underbelly in a way. So, Ken Kesey, what do you know about Ken Kesey, briefly? Anything
at all? He was part of the Merry Pranksters.
Yeah, really, the chief prankster, one might say.
Chief.
The former William of the Merry Pranksters. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And who are the Merry Pranksters?
I'm not really sure. They had a bus. The psychedelic bus.
Further, Jack Kerouac, or was he? No.
That's earlier. Yeah, Kesey is an inheritor in some ways of the Jack Kerouac.
Cassidy.
So Neil Cassidy is Jack Kerouac on the road. The driver with Kerouac is a guy named Neil Cassidy, who drove while on amphetamines and did amazing things. And Neil Cassidy became the driver for Ken Kesey's psychedelic bus. Any of you read Tom Wolfe's The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test? It's really about Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters. And all this develops out of course, the burgeoning hallucinogenic trade, one might say. And Ken Kesey, how did Ken Kesey get involved in this? Well, briefly, Ken Kesey's born in 1938. And so in 1962, he's 24. That's when Cuckoo's Nest is published. He's quite young. University of Oregon grad. He was on the university on a Rustin scholarship. He was a fantastic wrestler, nationally recognized wrestler. But he was also doing creative writing. So he was this strange hybrid between sort of the jock world, and he came from sort of a rural background. His family created Darigold Dairy. So he comes from that kind of context. He's at the University of Oregon, graduates, and gets a scholarship to Stanford, to the writing program. At Stanford, Wallace Stegner is the head of that program, and he is joined in the year that Kesey is there, probably 2 years. You have Robert Stone, who's one of the great living American novelists, and probably better known even, a guy named Larry McMurtry, who wrote Lonesome Dove, The Last Picture Show, and so on. These are classmates of Kesey at Stanford. So Kesey ends up in California, and a friend of his informs him, and I'm now looking at a biography of Kesey, that there was a veterans hospital nearby called Menlo Park Veterans Hospital, where the medical staff were employing academic locals to audition a new elixir I had a neighbor, Casey, recall, a psychologist booked to do the experiments one Tuesday, who chickened out. And so Casey volunteered to do it for him. Got paid $20 or something like that. So he said, the government said, we've discovered this nice room. We needed somebody to go in and look it over. 8 o'clock every Tuesday morning, I showed up. The doctor deposited me in a little room on his ward, dealt me a couple of pills or a shot or a little glass of bitter juice. Then the doctor locked the door, but popped back every 40 minutes to see if Kesey was still alive. He took some tests, asked some questions, left, leaving Kesey to study the inside of my forehead or look out the little window in the door. The window was 6 inches wide and 8 inches high, had heavy chicken wire inside the glass. These were the first LSD experiments that were government sanctioned. And Kesey was involved in this. And it was like, holy smoke. What is this? Such nirvana was, thanks to federal government LSD, Kesey said it was the best LSD he ever had. They gave me mine, paid me, and quite a few other rats, both white and black, to test it for them. Started it, so to speak. Then when they caught a glimpse of what was coming down in that little room full of guinea pigs, they snatched the guinea pigs out, slammed the door, locked it, barred it, dug a ditch around it, set two guards in front of it, and gave the helpless guinea pigs a good talking to and warned them, on threat of worse than death, to never go near that door again. And of course, what Kesey did was, he got a job at Menlo State Park Hospital, and the psychiatrist who first gave him the drugs had a drawer full of them, and Kesey just took them. And out of that, and then these were then synthesized by other people who got the formulas, famously a guy named Owsley, who then supplied Kesey and supplied the Grateful Dead, and they then had what were called the Kool-Aid acid tests. So they had big parties in San Francisco. They would spike the punch with LSD, and bands like the Grateful Dead and the Jefferson Airplane and so on would perform, and this was the beginning. You know, I mean, talk about transitions. This was a huge transition. It was when Kesey was working at the hospital. That was really what gave him the inspiration for what went through the steps. And it's out of that experience that he really created this novel. He claims, at least, that he, in his early drafts, that he then showed, he was then in the Stanford creative writing program, and it was there that he first read these drafts, and Murtry describes this experience and listening to Kesey read these opening chapters of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which were astonishing. The original drafts had a different narrator. It was really a surrogate for Kesey himself was the original narrator. In other words, a white Oregonian wrestler who had had this experience. And Kesey realized it wasn't working. I mean, the way he described it, it sounded like every other young white novelist in California trying to write an unusual novel. So he had to do something else. He claims that what he did was he took peyote, and it was while he was on peyote, which of course is used by certain Native American traditions. And it was during that experience that he suddenly found or heard the voice of his narrator. And that narrator is half Indian, half white, Chief Brompton. And that's what leads us to the opening paragraphs of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And so let's just read those aloud. And if we've got copies, and if you don't, look at them. And if somebody would just read a few paragraphs for us and get us a page or a page and a half, that would be great. From the beginning. Mm-hmm. They're out there.
They're out there. Black boys in white suits knelt before me to commit sex acts in the hall and get it mopped up before I can catch them. They're mopping when I come out. When I come out the dorm, all three of them, sulking and hating everything, the time of day, the place they're at, the people they got to work around. When they hate like this, better if they don't see me. I creep along the wall, quiet as dust on my canvas shoes, but they got special sensitive equipment to detect my fear, and they all look up, eyes glittering out of their black faces like the hard glitter of radio tubes out of the back of an old radio. Here's the chief, the super chief, fellas, old Chief Broom. Here you go, Chief Broom. Stick them up my hand and motion to the spot they aim for me to clean up today, and I go. One swats the back of my legs with a broom handle, the hurrying past. Ha, you look at him shagging. You look at him shagging, big enough to eat apples off my head, and he mine, me like a baby.
One more paragraph.
They laugh, and then I hear them mumbling behind me, heads closed together. Hum of black machinery, humming hate and death and other hospital secrets. They don't bother not talking out loud about their hate secrets when I'm nearby because they think I'm deaf and dumb. Everybody thinks so. I'm cagey enough to fool them that much. If my being half Indian ever helped me in any way in this dirty life, it helped me be cagey. Being cagey helped me all these years.
Well, here's Kenkesey. It's 1962. We've been talking about that context. What's the connection, if any, between what we were just describing and what Kesey is, let's say, tapping into? There he is in California, working at the mental hospital in this writing program, coming from University of Oregon. Any connection?
I think the underbelly. The underbelly of the beast.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Outsider, underbelly. Just elaborate a bit, either way, what you mean by that. Yeah. Well, you go first, okay.
You know, like you didn't fit in, you didn't feel like you fit in, and
okay.
It's trying to fit in.
Yeah, and he here, I mean, we have a narrator who's clearly an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
Indian who has been spending decades in this mental hospital pretending to be deaf and dumb, and that image of being deaf and dumb, I mean, it's an image of really being shut down, completely shut down, isolated in a certain way. I mean, it's like
protection.
Yeah, there's very much a sense of protection. Mm-hmm. There's a shell that he has created around himself. And so the mental hospital itself already has some of that sense. There's this shell, these walls that you're encased by, and he's been there, and he goes up and down, he's just sweeping these floors. And then the duff and dumb creates another shell of protection around himself. And that notion of fear just runs through this novel, actually. This chief talks about that over and over again. This is what drives him into that space. So very much that sense of the outsider. So yeah, now the underbelly, what do you mean by that?
Well, it's the way things really were, because he was used in the cage. Yeah. He was pointing out how they really talked and how they really felt. That wasn't common knowledge.
So one of the things, and this is one of the things that Kesey hits on in creating this narrator, is that the chief, because of his apparent deaf and dumb state, there's those around him are freer to do and say things that they wouldn't otherwise, and we'll see that in a passage just on the next page. So he actually becomes the eyes and ears. I mean, he is the narrator. He becomes the witness to what's going on for us. And he is a witness to what actually is a kind of underbelly. And so this hospital, again, there is a surface, there is a veneer of the way this hospital operates. And that veneer has a lot to do with whiteness. And so this white and black also comes up a lot in this novel. Right off the bat, we get that. right? And here's Kesey, who probably did not have a lot of connection to African Americans growing up where he did. And Kesey acknowledged when he created this narrator, he said, I've never met an Indian as far as he knew. I mean, he's growing up in Oregon, and then he's in California, and he has no connection whatsoever. So there's that. And yet, here's Kesey conjuring up, right from the get-go, this image. First of all, that opening line, they're out there. Talk about paranoia.
Yeah.
I mean, that novel, we are just walking into an energy field of paranoia with that opening line. Right? I mean, it's just, it envelops us. It's a little bit like you open the novel, and it's like walking through the doors of the mental hospital in some way. Of course, it's a first-person narrator. We are entering Chief Landon's perspective. This is his vision. And I'm not arguing that it's 100% accurate vision. He is clearly neurotic. I mean, that would be the word. I mean, he's imagining there's this machinery that's running through everything. And he tries to be careful to, not get caught up in the machinery itself. And yet, he is getting something accurate, it seems. Black boys in white suits, also an interesting image. Black boys in white suits, up before me to commit sex acts in the hall, get it mopped up before I can catch them. Weird, isn't it? I actually am reminded of, and this takes us back to the Beats, 1956. Allen Ginsberg reads his poem Power, right, before a public audience in San Francisco. It was a hugely transformational moment. Gary Snyder was present, was one of those readers at that event. And what Ginsberg Howell does is also bring the same sort of context of walking us into descriptions of sexuality that were not part of everyday literature, let's say. Weren't part of what most people were reading, weren't part of the movies, certainly weren't part of the music. And it's the contrast between Doris Day singing, How Much Is That Dog in the Window, which was a hugely popular hit in the middle 1950s. You've got Doris Day, and on the other hand, you've got Little Richard, you've got Chuck Berry, you've got Elvis Presley, who is not filmed below the waist on the Ed Sullivan Show because of the way he's moving his hips. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff that's just breaking loose. Right? And this is what Kesey is doing. They're mopping when I come out the dorm, all three of them, sulky and hating everything. The time of day, the place they live, the people they got to work around. So that's also part of what this chief is picking up. He can feel the hatred of these black guys who are working in this mental hospital for minimum wage, working under the woman who will be known as Big Nurse. Nurse Ratched, powerful white woman, and we're going to have to talk about that. This novel places a woman as the sort of power source in this hospital. It's explicitly described as a matriarch. And yes, as I was rereading the novel, to me, it's also sexist and misogynistic. I mean, there's something else going on here that feels really important to talk about in terms of what's going on in terms of gender, what's going on in terms of sexuality, and so on. But that's further down the road in the novel. But here you've got these black guys working for the white nurse, and who did they get to go deliver? Chief Brown. So that's what you get in this opening paragraph. You've got a hierarchy, you've got a pecking order. You've got the nurse, who is actually the power source, not the doctor in this case. It's the nurse. And then you've got these aides who are the assistants, right, but who obviously have very little power. And then down there you've got the chief. and the fact that he is a chief, he is explicitly the son of a chief, also is indicative of something really powerful and tragic that has been happening in this country. And we learn a little bit as the novel progresses about where Bromden comes from Oregon, and what happened to the tribal land when the tribal land was sold. And it was the chief who finally, and the implication is that it's his white wife who wants not to live on tribal land but move into town, and eventually the chief, along with others, sells the land so that it can then be either turned into developments or inundated with dams and so on. So so there's that history that's also running through this novel. And so you have this narrator who is himself one who inherits a really powerful, deep Native tradition that would go back thousands and thousands of years in this part of the country. That's a subtext that's barely there in the novel. It's just there in a few glimpses as Chief Bromden remembers fishing with his father, remembers his father before alcohol took him over. And so that connection to the natural world is going to be a really important thread. The chief has this connection back to that land, back to the rivers, back to the fishing. And McMurphy, who's going to come into this scene very shortly, brings some of that energy, some of that natural life with him that Bromden recognizes. He talks in one place in the novel about when McMurphy arrives, it's like suddenly there's the sweat of the fields, there's this, the smell of horses, there's this life. And it's very much, it's a male kind of life that is being remembered. And that's certainly Kesey. That's Kesey's own life, coming off of the farm and so on. And he's celebrating that kind of, again, what he associates with a strong male presence. And it's very Western. A very Western presence. We will see tomorrow in the passage that we're going to be looking at. But Murphy is walking around, with a towel around his waist, singing cowboy songs. Right? McMurphy is a kind of Western hero. He's a kind of John Wayne figure. And if we also want to think of him as a sort of counterculture hippie, he's this strange combination of things. Let's see if we got time. In the next paragraph, we should just finish off. The next paragraph, I'll just read this. I'm mopping near the war door when a key hits it from the other side, and I notice the big mirrors by the way the lock works, cleave to the key, soft and swift and familiar. She'd been around locked so long. She slides through the door with a gust of cold and locks the door behind her, and I see her fingers trail across the polished steel, tip of each finger the same color as her lips, funny orange, like the tip of a soldering iron. Color so hot or so cold, if she touches you with it, you can't tell which. So this is our introduction to Big Nurse.
Yeah.
And one of the things Kesey is able to do is he does create a kind of mythic quality out of these characters. And there's something about this nurse, and again, we'll have to talk about her role, and the fact, again, that it's a woman who is dominating the life of these men on the board. But Kesey does conjure up a potent figure here by the way the lock works, cleaved in the key, soft and swift. She's been familiar with locks for so long. I mean, there's almost something central about the way, that key fits in the lock, the way she's running her hands along those sides and those doors. She is a person who is comfortable there, and she is in control. She's in total control. She's the one with the key
the law.
What a metaphor there.
Yes, I'm leaving it off.
Yeah.
Freedom.
Yeah. So, we will,
I think we need to finish up. We will continue tomorrow. There are copies of the book in the bookstore if anybody gets inspired and wants to read along. If not, I will be giving handouts and I will remind those of you who perhaps read it 30 years ago or didn't read it at all, you'll be able to follow along. And again, one, continue working through the novel, but also keep putting it back into the context of 1962. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
He's not alive. No, I think he died just a few years ago.
On what?